Hi, this is Pip Phelan from the Poach Centre. I have with me today Scott Avery. Hi, Scott.
Hello, pleased to meet you and talk to you. So, yeah.
Yeah, nice to meet you. And you and I met at the Lower Chair Conference last year.
I remember your excellent presentation on intersectionality, and I thought, well, how good it was to actually hear someone speak about it and understand it and feel it. And so that's why I thought I'd come over and introduce myself to you.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. And that made me feel so good because after my presentation, I was obviously really nervous and I really spoke very fast at my presentation. It was the first conference presentation I've ever given. And having you come up afterwards and say that you work in intersectionality, particularly in disability spaces, and that my presentation was good, I really appreciate the encouragement. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. But I think you're touching on a point. There's intersectionality is quite a complex topic. And it's really, really hard to distill. There's so much you've got to cover because there's so much backstory to intersectionality. And I think the way that we're encouraged to present nowadays, whether it's via Twitter or, you know, very short time constrained, it kind of is preventing some of the more deeper discussions around, you know, what does marginalization really look and feel like for people who are, you know, outside, you know, working on the fringes. And that's what intersectionality is, really, you know, it's who's at the fringes of society. And I mean, it takes a bit of time to get there.
Absolutely. What area are you working in, Scott? What's your profession? And just tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm an Aboriginal man. So my nation is Warramai, which is in New South Wales. So driving from Sydney to Brisbane, you cross the Karoo and the Manning River, like the rivers analogy. So that's where my country is. Never actually lived on country. So I'm currently on Dharawal country now. Yeah, I'm also profoundly deaf, which that actually makes me a card-carrying member of the First Peoples Disability Network. Uh-huh. So that's a community organisation that I did a lot of my research with. I bedded my research there in an Aboriginal community organisation, and they're all Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people with disability who run the place from the board through the management. All that lived experience was there and very much a community feel to it. I spent a lot of time, I did my PhD there basically through that. But recently, earlier this year, I kind of went up, I think, the way forward is we need to be starting to teach these things and building research capacity. So made the jump. I'm now at Western Sydney University. I'm in the School of Social Sciences out there, which is when we get the profile and a bit of support and, you know, people know how it all comes together, I think it'll be a good place to do some work out there. Really keen on connecting. People are falling through the gaps in the system. And I think the answer is about connecting the system. And that's the kind of work that I want to do.
Yeah, you're also under incredible leadership there at Western Sydney. You've got some incredible academics there. So you also join a fantastic little unit.
So Professor Michelle Truncheon, who's the PVC, was Corey Scott of the Year about 2 or 3 years ago. So she's building an Indigenous support team. So people like Corinne Sullivan are there, very well-respected people, good support network in terms of the Indigenous side, and they're building capability in the disability area as well. So it's like I have to have a foot in both camps, straddle them both, and I think this work's starting to bring things together.
As an academic at Western Sydney, is there scope for disability to be included in the Indigenous studies component, or is it still something that's going to be kept separate like it is at a lot of universities?
No, that's what I want to do. So I want, you know, want to be part of, you know, we're teaching disability, not disability as a medical condition. And even within medical curriculum, you know, it's really, really hard to find, you know, my work that I want to bring. And there's a few scholars there. We're just starting to come together. We're teaching this as a disability. And the sociology of disability is a distinct discipline in its own right. Kind of following a little bit, and it's actually good that I've done had a lot of mentorship in the Indigenous area, Indigenous research, particularly Indigenous health, because I do think it's following that path in terms of its community, like, you know, located in community. These kind of things, there's a lot to learn from in terms of how do we develop, but I would there's not even an Indigenous disability. There's just not a lot out there. And it's been, you know, like it's needed almost a bit of a breakthrough moment to people realise that, you know, this is a really interesting, fascinating area. Yeah. It's under-resourced. And I think up until now, people are saying, oh, there's no career there. So they've kind of avoided it. And I think it's kind of been this self-fulfilling kind of neglect that we're trying to break through and saying, look, there's so much to be done, but it kind of needs, you know, where we're at, we're still trying to get it on the agenda. So I would regard myself as a little bit of almost like an activist researcher, you know, so.
I think you have to be as an Aboriginal person, as a person with a disability, any person, women tend to be that too, LGBTIQ people, you have to be an activist in these spaces in order to get through or to crack through, because particularly in the Western styled academy or Western health, it's very reductionist. There's no integrated look. So which is why I'm so interested in intersectionality, because all of a sudden, it shows the complexity for what it is. We're all very complex people, and there's all these other parts of us. We're not just Indigenous. We're not just a person with disability. We're not just LGBTIQ. We're not just a woman or a man. So there's all this complexity, and I think it's so important.
Oh, it's just fascinating when you were talking about it, and I'm kind of thinking you talked about comparative approaches, and I think a differentiating part, and I couldn't think I would have done it any other way, was that I located it in the First Peoples disability community. So really a community bedded, as grounded, you know, my research, I went in, this is how I had to frame my research question was, you know, what is your story? Because it was that and such an under-investigated area, and no one had actually asked people that question.
Yeah.
But a lot of the research that was being done on the community kind of was, we're looking at it and it's, well, this doesn't speak to us. It spoke to someone else's agenda or someone else's curiosity. I think part of the problem that we were encountering, and a lot of the reason why I wanted to do this as a research program, was that agenda was being set by other people and the narrative was held by other people and going, this is our narrative. And I'm in a community organization and I'm a policy at this, when I started this, I'm doing policy. I said, I can't use any of that stuff because it just does not resonate with what I'm hearing on the phone or people dropping in. And it just didn't gel. So I just said, we're just going to have to do it ourselves.
It's all about context. It's all about context. Unless you're a person with a disability, you actually don't understand the complexity and the nuance of living with a disability until you have one.
The backstory that I wanted to tell.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to tell it as a backstory. That's what I wanted to tell. I call it a narrative and a youth story, but it's interesting being in both. You want to capture stories of the people, but how I then had to reframe that in a way that it was seen as valid and legitimate in Western spaces. So a lot of the battles, the little micro battles that I had, I just had so many micro battles along the way from, well, you're an activist, you would say that, you know, that sort of, oh, well, that's subjective. And I kind of, that's where I started to be really clever and creative in starting to use Australian Bureau of Statistics data and going, well, this is your data, guys. So if you've got a problem with the ABS, and that's the basis for your policy decision making.
Yeah.
Major, major problems. But it was just this, you know, get in your box kind of thing. And I think that had as much to do with locating it as a community as any other factor. And just the notion of community people have knowledge, which is a different form of knowledge. And I've always said, look, it should complement, you know, other Western forms of knowledge to actually can coexist. There was a hierarchy in it that I challenged, inverted, and said, if there's any micro battle that has to be had, I'm taking the position of community. And I found it was, and this is how I describe it to academics now, it's like the academic community and my community, we had shared values, but what got ordered is how those values were ordered and what was prioritized. A lot of the problem I had is I wanted to publish work that was relevant to my community rather than in the academic peer-reviewed journals, because our community won't read that. But they'll read a book that we produced and that they can relate to, and it's published in a style, tone and language that they could engage with. So I prioritised that, which created problems down the track, because how was that recognised? And they're going, oh, this is just so unorthodox. So my PhD was the book, which I wrote about it, which I wrote for community. And then the back part of it, the theory was, well, how did I go about writing the book? And that was the academic critique. So I critiqued how I wrote the book to add what would be palatable for the academic community. So I started talking about discourse analysis and this kind of stuff. They couldn't accept on its own that we had shown a cultural model of knowledge without having to situate it in Western knowledge. I did the both, and even something like a literature review, because I had a big argument around the literature review, because there's no literature in our space. Because it's not relevant, you know, and I wanted to promote the voices of Aboriginal people with disability. So that's the whole point of why I'm doing this. So I have to do a systematic literature review. And I said, oh, okay. So I tried it. And I think I found four articles that were remotely relevant. And I just shoved them in. And I said, so then I changed and I cottoned onto this thing called a narrative review, meta-narrative review. And I thought, oh, okay, that can work with that. So I told the story of how the evidence base was basically colonized. People have been locked out from the word go. So whenever a researcher comes and does a systematic review, you get the obvious answer that Aboriginal people with a disability aren't included. No shit, Sherlock, you know, you gamed the selection criteria to exclude them.
Yeah.
And so some of the seminal articles that I found were, and I knew that they existed because my elders told me, oh, I did this paper back in 1991. I can't remember what it was called. And I was like an investigative journalist having to go back and find it. It's in the evidence base now because we got it in there through the PhD and I've been referencing it. But that title, it was called Access and Double Discrimination. That was the language. So it didn't have the word Aboriginal or Indigenous and didn't have the word disability, but it spoke to the essence of marginalisation. And I'm kind of thinking that's the thing, you know, a bit of a problem with disability, unless it's framed in a medical context, it just doesn't get picked up. I had to do them both. And then they go, oh, yeah, I get it now. And the thing I get about systematic reviews is that sets the tone. It's the first thing that happens with any policy. I'm going to do a systematic review. And it just sets the parameters of what you're looking at. And going, you just keep isolating, marginalising people if you do that. So I challenge that approach. And when you challenge those systems, you can imagine what you're going against. And I got to the point where I said, oh, look, stuff it. There's one of me and there's 37 universities. So, you know, you need me more than I need you. That was seriously how it got to some stages. And but it went right to the end of my PhD. One of the comments just before I submitted was, well, is retelling other people's stories actually research? And I thought about it and I just went, well, look at the scoreboard, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
47 Aboriginal people to speak with me. I think the best case is summing up every single other academic, but you've got about four. That was my defense. I just, yeah, well, did better than you guys, so suck it up.
What was your pathway to get to where you are now? What was your journey?
Yeah, it's really, I say it's almost an all over the shop journey, which is, I actually went from school, like left school into left university. I had an undergraduate degree in economics, which surprises many people now. Was working in that commerce area, exited that straight into that, the recession we had to have in the early 90s. So we're not working for a bank. Ended up then moving into a health insurance fund, but the health insurance fund was a bit of a bolshy health insurance fund. They were kind of a smaller one. Had this really ex gratia approach, you know, that they looked after people. And that's what gave me a really good health grounding. And so I was working more in the health behaviour change. So this is back in the 90s. And, you know, we're coming up against the medical model here again. Things like diabetes management, they're back in the 90s, they were just not around. You know, you went to hospital, you had your foot chopped off and, you know, it was the idea of prevention and why would you invest in that? You know, having those arguments back in the 90s. But I got on that and so got, you know, worked in health. And a lot of that sort of behavior change, I still carry that learning into, you know, what I'm doing now around, you know, what are we trying to change? You know, changing behavior, that sociology of health more so than the medical side of things. I picked up a few law degrees on the way because I was just working in things like governance. And then I did a master's degree in health information management. So I've got all these collection of little odd degrees which don't follow any particular pathway because I was just working on something at a time. I was just really curious. And the idea of doing, you know, research degrees gave me a bit of structure to learn something that, you know, I couldn't find by reading books. Went from that, got to about 10 years ago, I think it is now, and just had a meltdown, like had a year off. You know, it was a pretty intense personal period, actually. Like, don't talk about it much, funnily enough. It just kind of, people talk about my hearing and my deafness, but that's probably been the defining moment. And so recalibrated, you know, away from, you know, getting promoted into executive management kind of center. I just went back to what is it I wanted to do. And I loved doing the research side of it. So instead of being an administrator or a manager of it, I said, I actually want to start building a doing part. But when I was getting better, I guess, that's when, you know, I started meeting, reconnecting with some Aboriginal people and some Aboriginal people just behind the scenes, you know, just kind of, you'll never see them in, you know, I think about them regularly. And I said, I met a person who really helped me. And she was an Aboriginal social worker and she just really helped me. And I went, some of the things that I carried forward, I thought, I often think about her intervention at that time of my life. So it got me on the research path and it started, I ended up working with the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples in a health policy role because, you know, by then I was pretty solid in the health stuff. Got in there, was working on the Aboriginal Health Plan, National Aboriginal Health Plan, Torres Strait Islander Health Plan. And I'm in there going, where's disability? I can't find disability anywhere in here. Then one of those things that happens in an NGO, the Joe Hockey budget came and just cut funding 2 days before Christmas, told we mightn't have a job at the end of it. So I used that period to go, what do I want to do? And I said, you know what? It's Greenfields here. I'm going to have a crack at building a research. So, and Professor Lisa Jackson-Pulver, who's very renowned, she mentioned to me, she said, you know, why aren't you doing a PhD, you know, in a way that you can't kind of refuse. So I ended up starting it. And you just say, you just kind of got pulled into it.
Yeah.
It hasn't been like a conscious choice, but the moment I got into it, I said, yep, this is it. I found it. I'm going to be in this till I retire. This is it. I thought I found it. Yeah, it just speaks to me in a way. And that's when I got connected with the First Peoples Disability Network and just went, you know what, I'm just going to have a crack, you know, crash or crash through. I've come here with nothing, totally nothing to lose mentality. And now I'm a senior lecturer at Western Sydney and will be teaching it.
It's funny, a lot of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health professionals and academics I've spoken to, I don't know if anyone takes a really simple path. I think everyone's path is really complex. And I think that speaks to perhaps the Australian education system. Yeah. It speaks to a love and connection and commitment to community. And it speaks to some bigger purpose driving people through to where they end up to.
Comes back to it's all driven, and I see this in an organisation like First Peoples Disability Network. It's all driven by personal experience and the care back for community and the values that we have. You just got to find, I don't think it's like the right path. It's almost like the path of least resistance, you know, that you find your way into. I keep saying it's just like you just got to keep turning up at these things when you care about something so much. And I thought, I know that I'm in it for the long haul and I know it's not going to be straightforward, but I'm okay with that. And the people that I come up against, I often say, I will outlast you. You just need to know that up front. If you're going to give me crap as a bureaucrat, I know that I will outlast you. And I think that's the mentality. That's what I really get a kick out of with the Aboriginal side. It's that that endurance. People pass it off as resilience, but it's actually the endurance. And I can't put it any other way. You just keep turning up.
Yeah, it's funny that I love that you've used endurance because that's how I view it. I pretty much refuse to use the word resilience. And I wrote an article about this for Croaky actually about a month or so back, that resilience is a word that's really been utilized and commandeered by a neoliberalist perspective. Yeah. That is, if you can't last, if you can't stand up in the face of adversity, there's something wrong with you. You deserve to be where you are. Whereas endurance speaks to you have a lot of shit being thrown at you continuously time and time and time again, and you just stand there and be present in the face of it, and eventually with activism it falls away.
I do find that, and I'm picking this up in a lot of my thinking around discourse and how things get co-opted. And the other phrase that I'm starting to challenge is this strength-based discourse. Everything has to be presented as strength-based discourse. And I'm kind of going, yeah, but that masks over, okay, that means I can't talk about inequality. And I said that, but that's the truth of what we have.
Yep.
But just this strength-based discourse allows, and I've seen it in bureaucracies, government bureaucracies, got to talk strength-based discourse. It allows them to buy in on the romance of it all, but they can avoid the hard stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to let them. And so I think, you know, we've got to be careful how language like that gets co-opted. So strength-based discourse, you watch it now. You watch what's happening to it now. Resilience was another one. It's like, oh, you're not resilient. And I go, well, you know, one thing we do know is toughness, you know.
Yeah.
And we will outlast you. I promise you that. And I actually find you almost have to be. Because I always felt like when I was in policy land before I was a researcher, and you just sort of, you know, playing with, you know, don't rock the boat. You just got to don't rock the boat too. You know, you got to be in the tent, you know, all that language. I found out, look, nothing came of that other than just frustration. So at least if I go down now, it'll be in a, you know, on my terms kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I go, well, you know, so, you know, I've been doing policy interface work for 25 years. And just that language of having to play the, oh, don't be too, you know, uppity. I found the opposite now. I just kind of go on, you know what you buy. If you want me on any committee, you know what you're buying now. So
what have you learned about influence, impact and leadership from all of the work that you've done and all the experience that you've had?
It's funny about when people talk about leadership, I don't think like that. It's really strange because I've always felt that I'm part of a community. And so this notion of leaders and that, I mean, they'll naturally emerge. But for me, it's the shared values. So I think our community are leading things more so than an individual or something. And I find that really fascinating that we do come together as a movement. You know, there are obviously people who we look up to and admire, and our elders, you know, our professors and people like that. And the thing that I get from them is how they model the values, that integrity. I know I've worked in a style that suits me now. Like, I'm not trying to copy something. It just helps me to just kind of be me, you know, like in my style. How I present that and how I subscribe to the integrity, the community values. We share, you know, we support each other, we share. It contrasts to the individualistic type leadership that you see in Western discussions of leaders, you know. So people go, oh, do you have a personal development program for leadership? And I said, oh, no. Just my personal development as leadership. I got to talk to 47 Aboriginal people with disability as part of my research. And I've regarded them. Now, some of them were homeless, lived in town camps. They would teach me more than sitting with someone who's played the game, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I learn from different things and different experiences, and I create them and I get access to them because I'm part of a community. So, and people like, I'm very careful not to say this in the university, but I really couldn't care less if I'm a professor or PVC.
Yeah.
I want to work in Aboriginal disability, and I want to give that a platform for the next five. For me, if we think about leadership, is I'm thinking for the next generation that's coming through.
Yeah.
And what are some of the barriers that we can knock over and the platforms that we could build for them? not my time's run, but, you know, like, you know, I started this when I was 45, I'm not 25, you know. We've had 250 years of being told, you know, since the Industrial Revolution that people with disability are not able. I mean, that's the nature of the word. And we've just had all these systems, you know, it's that hardwired that we just got to come back to first premises and go, it's actually about inclusion. If you get that philosophy, get that relationship kind of model happening, that's where the empowerment comes from. And it's not about, you know, having an empowerment system or that. It's actually going, no, we're you know, we can spot this. We know when people want to bring us in or not. We can feel it. It's all about inclusion. And I describe it as, and I'm very cautious of saying this because, again, it could be one of those terms or phrases that gets co-opted and we buy in the romance and we avoid all the sort of truth-telling that goes behind it. But I see it as almost like there's this different understanding of humanity, you know, and a notion of, you know, people, you know, that genuine thing around diversity being, you know, we take all comers as they present themselves versus an ideal kind of version of what man can be. And if you don't meet that, then there's something wrong with you or you're broken or, you know, and that's the social order that got imported into Australia, you know, because that's why it's decolonizing work. Because we talk, think of decolonization and around, you know, the massacres, the land and all that kind of stuff. We actually depossessed people of their body too. That made them have to fit, conform to a social order, which is antithetical to our culture. So I think a lot of this is around reanimating the culture of belongingness.
I think you're in a really, well, you are in a unique position as a Aboriginal disability academic. I'm not sure that there's many, if any, others working at Australian universities at the moment. There are plenty of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disabilities who'd probably love to get there. What would be your advice to people who want to work in this space? And, you know, is there anything that you could give them to encourage people to go and work in this space?
I think in thinking this is something that I want to create, that it's a safe and inclusive environment. And the nature of this work, if you're working in Aboriginal disability, is to create, it starts, its first premises are it's a safe and inclusive place. But I do understand that there's a lot of, and I've been working with a number of students very informally who are wanting to go into university as a start. They're confronted with things that are hard. And some things should be hard because they're taken on a degree. And, you know, it is actually hard work. You have to do that. But there's things that should not be hard. Things around access. And when I mean access, it's not just like getting around the building. It's having a teacher and teaching staff that kind of gets some of the tacit kind of access barriers that you might encounter. When you're a newcomer into this space, you can't differentiate between what should be hard and what should not be hard. And I was kind of doing a lot of informal mentoring with people to kind of go, okay, we can help break down some of these things that should not be hard. And there's ways and means to access assistance in that. And you shouldn't need to carry that yourself. Mm-hmm. You should be studying, which should be hard. And we need people who are prepared to do that hard work, be the thinkers, be the critical analysts. You actually need to work on that. That's something, you know, that's what you should be doing. And, you know, I've always made myself available to people and I want to encourage people to do it. And it's like, this is a frontier kind of work and we're just cracking this frontier. And I would say that if you come into this space, I can promise you, you'll be doing something that won't have been looked at or done at before. So, and if you're an Aboriginal person and you're an Aboriginal person with disability, there is no one that can replicate your experiential knowledge. Mm-hmm. So that is your competitive differentiating advantage. As I say, they may have the army, but we have the hill. Yeah. And there's no way, if they want to be inclusive and self-determining, that they can do that without talking to us. We're still cracking the entry point. And if there's someone out there listening to this podcast and really wants to do something, please get in touch with me. I've lived it, learn from me, learn things I've done well, learn things I've had an absolute shocker with. So you can use that and create your pathway and follow what you want to do. And the more of you we can get the bigger a peer group that we can support each other. I say I'm proud Warramai, and everyone says that when they're Aboriginal, hear that. I'm actually proud to be profoundly deaf. There is a culture of being profoundly deaf. And you know what? I love it.
Yeah.
And I can take, I can do, I call it my, you know, I don't want to be romantic again. It's my superpower.
Yeah.
I can take this off, and the peace and tranquility I have that shuts the outside world, where I'm totally can't hear a sound, is actually so serene. And I kind of thought, gee, I wish I could share this with some other people.
Yeah.
Because it's such a beautiful experience. So I'm actually proud to be deaf. And I think what you're seeing emerge in the disability community, and as the Aboriginal community would talk about self-determination, that kind of thinking is coming in the disability community as well.
Yeah.
So people are going, I'm a disabled person.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of it. And I think that's coming. That's coming. The next generation of scholars are going to be part of that and be the critical thinkers that capture that history and write about it and analyze what it means in terms of a broader social. We need people. We need more people who get it and live it. They'll be the scholars. They'll be the ones that write it.
It's interesting that you talk about it as a superpower. I worked for 20 years in the neuromusculoskeletal space. I worked as a manual clinician for a long time. And I taught a lot of clinical myotherapists, massage therapists. I taught osteos and chiros and a whole range of manual therapy professionals. And possibly the most outstanding professional that I remember was young woman. She was only 18 and she was blind, and she needed a lot of assistance within the classroom. As a hands-on professional, someone who could communicate to clients, someone who could take an incredible client history assessment and then perform sort of really complex procedures with clients, she was probably the most outstanding that I've ever seen in my entire almost 20 years of teaching in that space. It's funny when people think about disability, they think about, you know, a person who can't, whereas I think that it gives so many people a real leading edge in a lot of spaces.
I always thought we're the natural problem solvers.
Yeah.
You know, I walk into a room, I go, where do I need to sit to optimize my communication? I innately do that. Someone who might be in a wheelchair might be going, I've got to get to uni. I don't just get in the car and drive. I've got to figure out. So you kind of build in problem solving in a way that is just at a different level to the rest of the community. And I think, you know, it's funny because I did do some work like in strategic planning. When I do it with a disability, I just go straight to the issue. You know, it's just like, you know, there's no fluff. Tell it like it is.
Yeah.
Bang, come out in a day, which takes other organisations like 3 or 4 days of crap you got to wade through. And I thought, just as your decision making. And I thought there's something to do with people with disability just being innate problem solvers.
Yeah.
Because what they have to do to navigate their day is, oh, I've got this problem, bang, 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 you know, one after the other.
Yep.
And they just do it. The other thing is you've actually had a personal experience with someone with a disability. And it's fascinating because I'm feeling like a bit of a foreign object in the university, as you said. It's not just Aboriginal academics with disabilities, academics with disability generally. It's just not a lot. It had that visible presence. I know one other person that has a cochlear implant, and I'll go on. I know maybe 100 Aboriginal academics.
Yeah.
I can think of one who I know that's profound. I haven't met this person, but I know of them. They put on their profile. There's probably more, but they don't identify that way. In the way that Aboriginal academics might.
Yeah.
I know of one other academic who's not an academic anymore, moving to the human rights area, who identifies as having a close affiliation with the Australian disability community. When I mean that is being a disabled people's organisations. Few people have been there in the service side, but this community advocacy, so few.
What do you see are the major keys to empowering the lives of Indigenous people locally and around the world? And for you, not just Indigenous people, but Indigenous people with disabilities?
So I think it comes down to the role of storytelling. It's almost like we need to generate empathy, and I'm not talking in this sort of sympathetic way. It's just to get people to really critically reflect on their part. And I've always think I'm have my own story, you know, it's so different to other people's stories, you know, it's kind of, I recognize I've got a privilege as well in that I have a platform and other people are, have shared their stories with me on trust. And I use that to share their stories because I have a platform that they won't have. That you got, you know, someone like me telling that story kind of tells us how much, how far we really need to get to know about the experiences of people in Australia, you know, and people living lives in Australia. And there's some people I met were living in town camps.
Yeah.
Just the emotional impact of having that knock on the door from a department that's going to come and take your children away. We kind of deal with that in really sanitized language.
Mm-hmm.
Which avoids the kind of human impact. You know, they use words like food security. I said, that's actually people starving. And it just kind of, we've created this comfort zone on how we address some of these issues. And I'm very cautious to say, people say, you know, what's the answer to this? I said, I don't come with answers because I don't think we've done that work. We just kind of need a bit of truth-telling first.
Yeah.
And truth telling is you just need to be, as someone who's witnessed, you know, avoidable suffering for people, and it's avoidable, and just a kind of lack of compassion in systems that are designed to support them, but they just run like corporations,
uh-huh.
Very humanless corporations. We kind of lost the purpose a bit.
Yeah,
the role that I've set myself to is be a little bit of that platform through which stories could be told, and hopefully we'll bring in people to kind of go, okay, we kind of get it, you know, people who are in positions of power in systems, and the system isn't hearing this story because all their quality assurance or customer survey just keeps going to the people who are in the system in the first place.
Uh-huh.
But what if you've been locked outside that system? Who tells that story? So that's where I've kind of looking to share that and then get people to do that critical reflection first.
Yeah.
And then go, okay, what do we really need to do? Because it's really challenging the assumptions upon which systems and support programs are built. It's giving a place and a role for people who have been locked out or disempowered. And so they actually have a role to play, not just in covering what the issues and their problems are, but they need to own the answer too. Yeah. And I'm hopeful that people will look at some of this and do a better job than I am at making the systems work better. Because I've never run a system. I don't know how to make a system work. I've never been in a system. I've been outside it. So for me to go in, I think it's almost as gratuitous as the other way. People go, and I tell us about your experiences. I go, and I've never run it. But we need to work with people to create that a climate where there is that shift in power. Because
yeah.
That's what empowerment really is. You consciously have to go, okay, I need to relinquish power. If I want to empower people who are disempowered, there are people who actually need to relinquish it. I think that's the first step. And how can we cultivate Aboriginal people with disability being part of the solution and being in positions where they can be first-hand advisors on how these things run or own them? You know, that's where we've got to get to.
Dr. Scott Avery, thank you so much. It's been incredible interview, and I've loved speaking with you, and you've got so much to share, and I'm so looking forward to learning more from you over the next few years.
Oh, great. Look, it's been my pleasure, and you know, I love this discussion, so I may have gone over time, but you know, it's a really enthralling topic, and I think people will engage with it sort of once they touch it. It's like, oh really, this is what it's like, and you get to meet some wonderful people through these. So thank you for the chance.